Artistic consultant is what I'm calling myself now. Tell Barry here what you do. Kenny laughed. Frank, come on. I make pop stars into artists. Frank nudged Barry with his elbow. Listen to this. Kenny shook his head and waved his hand, begging off. No. Come on. I'd like to hear it, Barry admitted. Oh, all right. He smiled, paused, took a sip of his wine. There comes a time in the career of most singers and musicians, if they're successful enough, when they want to be taken more seriously, when they have enough fame and fortune and start to crave critical respect. That's where I come in. For an outrageously inappropriate fee, I choreograph a media campaign, stage interviews, and go over lyrics in order to make rock critics think my clients are serious artists. Music journalists are probably the most gullible people on the planet, and they're desperately willing to buy into the fantasy. I remember one time Kurt Cobain showed up for an interview wasted and wearing a dress, and the interview wrote a glowing piece on how Cobain was challenging gender stereotypes. Kenny laughed. So it's not as hard as you might think to con these people into believing that a 22-year-old high school dropout is now making profound observations about the human condition. So how do you do it? Barry asked. Kenny smiled. Trade secret. But I will clue you in on two important words. Spiritual journey. It's my most tried-and-true method. I take some of that god-awful drivel these kids are writing, slip in a few references to fate or a higher power, tell them to stay out of the limelight for 6 months, and to inform everyone that they're recharging their spiritual batteries. Voila! Instant artist. They return from their hiatus with a new respect from critics who now laud their artistic growth and ambition. It was an interesting occupation, Barry had to admit, and one that he had not even known existed until now. One of those new entrepreneurial jobs that the high techies were always talking about. Still, it was Kenny's eye that had really piqued Barry's curiosity. Horror writer-itis rearing its head once again. He casually glanced at the blue patch. How many people lost eyes these days? And how many of them wore patches? It seemed anachronistic, slightly exotic, like something out of another era. But he knew it would be impolite to ask about, and he was resigned to the fact that neither Frank nor Kenny was likely to bring up the subject. Hell, maybe the man's eye was fine. Maybe pirate chic was big in the rock world these days, and Kenny was just riding the cresting wave of the trend. Once again, he felt Frank's hand slap his back. Barry, here's a writer, like Stephen King. Kenny looked intrigued. Is that so? I'm a horror writer, Barry admitted. Published, I assume? He smiled. I wouldn't call myself a writer if I wasn't. In fact, I wouldn't be calling myself a writer unless I was making a living at it. You're a rare breed. I know writers who've never even written anything. Barry chuckled. So do I. Have any of your novels been optioned for film? Not yet, no. I have some contacts in the film industry, Kenny said. I'll ask around for you. Put in a good word. If I'm not imposing or overstepping my bounds. Wouldn't you like to read one first to make sure I'm not a complete hack? Hacks sell their stuff to Hollywood all the time. Hackdom's no drawback in the film industry. Not that I think you are one, he added quickly. Barry smiled. No offense taken. Besides, if Frank and Ray vouch for you, that's good enough for me. I'm always ready to help a fellow outcast. Frank was beaming. It seemed odd to Barry that someone with connections in the music and film industries would have a place out here in the middle of nowhere, but he was a novelist and refugee from California himself and should be the last person to generalize and stereotype about the type of people attracted to Bonita Vista. Again, he wondered about the patch, and he thought that maybe, despite the professorial appearance, Kenny Tolkien was like Norman MacLean, one of those outwardly cultured men with a rough-and-tumble rural background. It made as much sense as anything else. You know, Frank said, with talents like you two, we ought to be able to bring the fucking Homeowners Association to its knees. I take it you're having a problem with the Ass-Association? Kenny derisively pronounced the word Ass-Association. You could say that. I got a notice yesterday that I have to repaint the trim on my house. I just painted it last year, but apparently their inspectors found minute spots that are peeling on the south side, the side exposed to the sun. So either I try to find a massive ladder tall enough to reach the roof on the hillside and risk breaking my neck, or I shell out big bucks to have it painted. Kenny shook his head. That certainly sounds familiar. Last fall, I received notice that I was to resurface the asphalt on my driveway. I'd had it done only the month before. So did you? Hell no. I hosed off the driveway, sprayed off the dirt, and it looked as good as new. I called up and told them I'd done it, and I haven't heard back from them since. Maybe I should just tell them I did it, Frank said. Make them go up again and inspect it, then have it done. They all laughed. Barry told how he'd gotten a notice to paint the chimney cap for their wood-burning stove and to pick up pine cones on the property. There was one damn pine cone, he said. One. And for that, they gave me a written notice? Did you paint your chimney cap? I had to hire someone to do it. Some guy named Tom Peterman, who didn't even come out himself but sent his son up to do it, a week late. Be prepared to paint it again next year, Frank said morosely. Peterman's the one who did my trim. Kenny chuckled. Welcome to rural America. Gradually, other partygoers started gathering around. People with their own complaints, their own tales of confrontation and capitulation. And like the previous party, it soon became a round robin, with one homeowner relating a horror story while the others listened, and then another taking his turn after that. It was what they all had in common, this hatred of the homeowners association. It was why the Dysons had brought them all together, probably why they had become friends with Ray and Liz to begin with. Barry had never been a joiner, had always had a deep fear and distrust of groupthink, but the tribal aspect of this made him feel surprisingly positive. It was empowering, knowing that there were others like you, that different people felt the same things you felt, had the same reactions to things that you did. Greg Davidson dropped the evening's biggest bombshell. We're leaving, he said. We can't afford to live in Bonita Vista anymore. He put an arm around his wife, Winona. The Davidsons had been quiet through most of the diatribes, not registering much interest or enthusiasm in the anti-association rants that had become the party's focal point. That was unusual. Barry didn't know Greg well, but from what he'd seen at the Dysons' earlier get-together, the man was not shy about speaking his opinion and was a very vocal opponent of the association. Mike Stewart put a hand on Greg's shoulder. What happened? Greg glanced around the room without meeting anyone's eyes. It's the association. They've been targeting us for a long time, and we just can't fight them anymore. He sounded as though he were going to cry. It's the gate, Winona explained. Barry was confused. You can't afford to live here because of the gate? They put that gate in to get rid of us. Mike shook his head. I don't think... Hear me out. Greg took a deep breath. We voted against the association on the last ballot. We knew it was a risk, but I couldn't justify supporting them anymore. And I didn't want... I was tired of just caving in. There were nods of understanding all around, but Greg must have seen the look of incomprehension on Barry's face. You're new, he said. You haven't been through one of their elections, or one of the farces they call elections. No, Barry admitted. They coincide with the annual meeting on Labor Day weekend. You'll get a ballot, and on it will be the names of the current board members. Next to each name will be a box that says approve. And that's it. There are no other candidates running. There is no space to put in a write-in candidate. There's not even a disapprove box. So all you can do is ratify the existing board. It's true, Mike said. I don't know why they even waste time on such a charade, but I suspect there's some sort of legal requirement that homeowners associations hold yearly elections, and this is their way of getting around that. Anyway, I was tired of supporting those assholes. In the past, we just didn't bother to vote. We threw away our ballot. But this time, I made my own boxes next to the approve boxes, and I wrote in impeach. Needless to say, it did not go over well. I received a threatening letter warning me to cease and desist from making libelous and disparaging remarks about board members. I wrote back that I could find no bylaw forbidding me from saying whatever the hell I wanted about board members, and I pointed out that my attempt to institute a free election was hardly disparaging or libelous. "Then they put in the gate," Winona said. Greg nodded. "Then they put in the gate. Well, not right then. A few months later. But we knew the reason." Barry looked over at Maureen, who was frowning. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm lost." Greg glanced around embarrassedly. "We don't exactly..." He sighed. "Bonita Vista is a little out of our range. We loved this place, and we wanted to live here. And with a little creative financing, we were able to swing it. But we were always hanging on by a thread. The association knew that. So they decided to just push us over the edge. They couldn't get us on any of their precious technicalities. They couldn't find a single rule or regulation that we'd broken or even bent. So about 6 months ago, they decided to turn Bonita Vista into a gated community." He held up a hand. "I know they said it was for other reasons, and who knows, that might have been part of it. I'm sure they did want to prevent vandalism and burglaries and keep out the locals and prevent outsiders from driving on our fair streets. But the timing of it..." He shook his head. "What they really wanted to do was increase the property values of the homes up here in order to increase property taxes. They knew we couldn't afford an increase, that it would drive us out. And now it has." "We got our property tax bill from the mortgage company," Winona said. "And we owe nearly $1,000. There's no way in hell we can pay that. We're in debt as it is." "Maureen here is an accountant," Mike offered. "Maybe she'd be willing to look over your finances, see if there's some way..." "Sure," Maureen said quickly. "I'd be happy to." Greg smiled painfully. "Thanks for the offer, but no. We know when we're licked. And we're not about to get ourselves in deeper just out of spite. The game's over. They've won. And we're going to turn tail and run as far away from Bonita as humanly possible." "But your job," Mike said. "I'm quitting. We're selling the house and starting anew in Arizona. My brother lives in Phoenix and thinks he can get me a job at Motorola." He looked out the window. "I was born in Corbin," he said. "So was Y. And ever since I was a teenager, all I wanted was to be able to afford a house in Bonita Vista. It seemed like a paradise to me, and I thought if I ever got in here, I'd be happy. Things would be perfect. But it's been a hellhole." He turned to face the gathered guests. "You guys have all been great. But most of the people here..." He shook his head. Ray emerged from one of the back rooms. He'd been MIA for the past hour, and Barry wasn't sure how much he'd heard, but he'd obviously heard some of it. Just as obviously, he'd had a little too much to drink. "Fuck the association," he said, walking into the center of the room. "Those bastards can kiss my ass." There were echoes of support. "Yeah, you tell them. Damn straight." "You're not going anywhere," he told the Davidsons. "We'll all chip in and pay your property tax. Hell, I'll pay the whole damn thing myself if I have to." He put a boozy arm around Greg's shoulder. "We can't let those bastards win." Both Greg and Winona were shaking their heads. "I can't let you do that," Greg said firmly. "Besides, we've made up our minds. We're leaving. We're through with this place." But Ray was on a roll. "Civil disobedience. That's what we need here. If we all rebelled, if we all refuse to follow orders and go along with their dictates..." "There's more of them than there are of us," Mike pointed out. "Then we'll kick their asses. I threw one of those peckerheads off my lot last month, and he went running home to mama. They're cowards. I'm telling you, we get a group of men together, men who have something between their legs, and when one of us gets a notice or an ultimatum, we all march over to the board members' houses and beat the living shit out of them." "Yeah," Frank said. The rally went on from there. Despite the Davidsons' depressing story, Barry walked home at midnight feeling pumped up. The ideas Ray and his increasingly drunk guests came up with for thwarting the Homeowners Association were outlandish and ridiculous, but the spirit was there, and that made him feel good. Such sustained and unanimous hatred of the Homeowners Association gave him hope. It had been over a week since he and Maureen had made love, but they made up for it that night in a marathon session that brought to mind the early days of their marriage. By the time he finally settled down to sleep, he was dead tired, and in his dreams, Neil Campbell arrived at his garage sale with his prissy mouth and his clipboard, and Barry beat the tar out of him. 17. Maureen awoke with nothing to do. It was not something to which she was accustomed, and while she'd known that this was bound to happen, she was still not entirely sure how to deal with it. She was not a workaholic, not by any stretch of the imagination, but she was not a slacker either, and while Barry could easily sit around all day staring into space and contemplating his navel, she was not wired for sloth, did not know how to enjoy huge blocks of free time. She was used to having a job, a regular job with regular hours, and even her weekends and vacation days had always been planned out, her leisure time structured. But as of yet, there wasn't enough work here to keep her occupied on a full-time basis. She'd known that, and she'd told herself to stretch things out, but she wasn't wired for procrastination either, and as always, she'd done the best job she could in the quickest time possible. The fiscal year-end was coming up for most of her California clients, and 2 weeks from now she'd be so busy that she wouldn't have time for sleep. But for now, she had nothing to do. Even her gardening was all caught up. She'd watered and weeded yesterday, trimmed dead flowers and fed the plants. So unless she wanted to start repainting the house, she was out of luck. Kicking off the sheet and sitting up, Maureen looked down at her still flat stomach. She and Barry had often discussed having children, and she couldn't help thinking that a baby would provide her with plenty of work to fill up these empty hours. But she felt guilty for even speculating about having a child for such a selfish reason. It was as bad as those accountants, and she knew quite a few of them, who planned their children's birth dates in order to get the maximum tax credits. She sighed. At least when Barry had been home, she'd had someone to talk with. But with him at his office, she was alone and on her own. Maybe she'd go down and meet him for lunch, she thought. That might be fun. And on the way back, she could stop over and see Liz, or drop in on Tina Stewart, who'd been asking her to come by and see the new roses she'd planted. Maureen hopped out of bed, feeling better. There were things to do. She was not entirely at loose ends, and the gloom that had threatened to engulf her only a few moments before disappeared completely, replaced with a more familiar and welcome feeling of energized purpose. As she ate breakfast and listened to Howard Stern, whose show they got on a powerful and remarkably clear radio station out of Las Vegas, she decided to start her morning with a little exercise. It was a weekday. The tennis courts were no doubt empty. And she thought she'd hit a few balls, practice her serve, start using this free time wisely, and get into shape. Afterwards, she'd take a shower, then pack a lunch and surprise Barry down at his office. Maybe they'd even go on a picnic. Maureen changed out of the jeans she'd put on and slipped into a pair of shorts. She grabbed her racket and a can of balls from the closet and jogged down the hill to the tennis courts. As she'd known, as she'd hoped, there was no one playing. She had the courts to herself, and she picked the left court, the one nearest the trees, standing in alternate corners and hitting balls into the opposite squares. Serving was the weakest part of her game, and although she and Barry were pretty evenly matched, if she could tighten up her serve, that might tilt the balance in her favor. A red Mustang roared down the street, sliding to a late-breaking stop in the small gravel parking space adjacent to the tennis courts. Beat-heavy music thumped from behind dark-tinted windows, and a moment later two teenage boys hopped out of the vehicle, rackets in hand. One was blonde, one had black hair, both were scruffy, and Maureen saw them and then looked immediately away, not wanting to make eye contact. She wanted to practice on her own, without interference, and she kept hitting balls, ignoring the newcomers. But that soon grew hard to do. The boys had brought several cans of balls with them, but she could see out of the corner of her eye that they merely hit the same ball lightly back and forth, not playing a real game, not even putting effort into a decent volley. They seemed more interested in their conversation, a disgustingly graphic and obviously exaggerated account of their sexual exploits that grew louder and louder with the telling. Part of her wanted to tell them to either quiet down or take it somewhere else, but they looked like the kind of kids who'd talk back, and the last thing she wanted was to start a verbal volley with these punks and have to stand there and argue with them for the next 20 minutes. It was easier to just let it slide and try to ignore them. As if reading her mind, they took the volume up another notch. She had one of those skanky pussies, man. Smelled like she'd been shitting out of that hole, if you know what I mean. Been there, done that. I ate her anyway, though. Just held my breath and chowed down for old glory. There was a harsh laugh of recognition in response, and Maureen picked up one of her balls and casually glanced over at the next court. She was nonplussed to see that both of the teenagers were staring at her. "I hear tell those bitches from California have twats of gold," the blonde kid said. "Taste like honey." He smiled in a way that made her feel as though she needed to take a shower, and Maureen looked quickly away. She glanced up at the security camera, grateful that it was there. She wanted to pack up her stuff and leave, but she didn't want those punks to think they were driving her off, that she was afraid of them, so she finished picking up her balls and moved to the next corner on her rotation, continuing to practice her serve. One ball went into the net, and she walked forward to retrieve it. A tennis ball flew over from the next court, smacked her square in the back. She straightened up. "Hey!" she called out angrily. "Watch where you're hitting!" The dark-haired boy laughed harshly, and the thought occurred to her that it had not been an accident. She turned away, and two balls came whizzing over. One sped past her head close enough that she felt the breeze, and the other hit the back of her bare right calf with a loud slap. The pain was tremendous. She was sure there'd be a welt, and furious, she picked up the ball and swung her racket, hitting the ball over the fence and into the trees. She walked purposefully over to where their other ball lay, intending to swap that over the fence as well, but two more balls came at her, each of them hitting her hard in the buttocks. She'd had enough. She was leaving. And if either of those two shits tried to stop her or harass her in any way, she was going to take her racket and smash it across his smirky face. She grabbed her can from where she'd placed it by the fence and began picking up balls. Hers were easy to identify, dull old-fashioned grayish-white as opposed to their fluorescent yellow-green. The last one was caught in the chain-link fence near the border of the two courts, an attempted serve that had gone wild. Below it was one of their balls, and as she walked over, she saw that the blonde kid was coming over to get his ball as well. She slowed her pace. He slowed his. Clearly, he intended to reach the spot the same time she did, and though she definitely didn't want to meet up with him, she also didn't want to show any fear. Her grip tightened on the racket. They reached the fence at the same time, and she ignored him as she pulled her ball from the chain link and dropped it into her can. Blondie dropped to his knees to pick up his ball. "Aren't you from California?" he asked. Smiling, he licked his lips suggestively and looked at her crotch. Maureen felt violated, and she wanted nothing more than to take off the top of his scalp with her racket, but she pulled away in as dignified a manner as she could muster. "Go to hell," she said coldly. Both of the boys laughed, but neither tried to stop her as she walked back across the court to the exit. She checked out the license plate of the Mustang and committed the numbers to memory. She'd call Chuck Shea when she got home, sick the association on those assholes, or on their parents. Someone needed to take responsibility, and at this moment she didn't care who. If Chuck thought it best to find the kids' dads or double their dues or kick them out of Bonita Vista entirely, well, they had her permission. But on her way back up the hill, she saw something that made her change her mind. Or rather, someone. He was standing across the culvert to her right, in front of a low wooden house with too few windows. She had not noticed the house before, so unobtrusive was it and so far back was it set, but she noticed it now because of the man. He was at least 6'5", with a shock of white lorn-green hair that seemed incongruous atop his unlined baby face. But it was the crutches that drew her attention, that and his missing leg. For he stood there watching her, supported by the tallest metal crutches she had ever seen, crutches that glinted in the sun and shined in her eyes. The long left leg of his tan pants was filled out with his remaining limb, but the empty right pant leg dangled there, swaying gently in the air, rather than being pinned up or cut off. Maureen tried to smile, gave a wave and an anonymous pleasant, "Hi." But the man swung away and hobbled back toward the house more quickly than she would have thought possible. There was fear in his flight, a fear that she had glimpsed on his face in the brief second before he turned away, and she looked immediately behind her to make sure there wasn't an approaching bear or murderous criminal, but of course there was not. She was the only one on the road, and she watched him hop up the gravel driveway and disappear into the house. A moment later, she saw his face at one of the small windows, staring at her and scowling. Despite his obvious fear, something about the man seemed threatening to her, and she hurried on up the road. Again, she thought of the association, of telling them that this weirdo had been bothering her, trying to scare her, but she stopped herself. Where was this going to end? Was she going to run crying to the association every time life wasn't perfect? Every time she encountered a minor inconvenience or saw something slightly out of the ordinary? She had changed her mind about calling Chuck, and it took her a moment to realize why. She didn't want to be beholden to the homeowners association. That was a strange way to think. She and Barry paid dues, and she had every right to expect that they be provided services for those dues. And the association had helped her out with that lunatic Deke Meldrum and had not asked for anything in return. But the feeling remained that by asking for help she would be calling in a favor that would be expected to be repaid at some time in the future. As much as she tried to deny it, as much as she refused to admit it, she seemed to have bought into Ray's and Barry's paranoid mindset. Of course, the fact that nearly everyone at the Dysons' party had had association horror stories lent their paranoia a certain amount of credence, but it was not logical arguments or recitations of actual events that swayed her. It was her own nebulous feeling that if she called on the association for help, she would owe them. What if, she wondered, and here she was really edging into Barry and Ray territory, those two teenagers at the tennis courts had been sent over specifically to harass her in the hopes that she would call the homeowners association and thus be indebted to them. That was ridiculous. But although her other thoughts were almost as ridiculous, she did not discount them, and she hurried up the last section of hill, feeling better only after she was safely back inside the house with the door shut and locked behind her. 18. Ray spent the morning sanding and restaining the deck. It probably didn't need to be painted for another year, but he liked to keep on top of things, liked to have the house looking good. Besides, he knew it drove the homeowners association crazy that they couldn't cite him for neglect. Although they'd no doubt find something to jump on his ass about. They always did. He took a shower afterward, scrubbing his arms with Ajax in an effort to get the redwood stain off his skin. He was reaching around, trying to clean off his elbow, when the shower door was pulled open. He let out a startled cry. 6 men stood in his bathroom, staring at him. It was not Neil and Chuck and Terry this time, not the underlings or the toadies, not the newcomers. It was the board, the old men who ruled and ran the association. They stood close together in the confined space, faces partially obscured by shower steam, draped in the absurdly decorated judicial robes that they used when presiding over meetings. Ray shut off the water. "Get the hell out of my house," he ordered. The steam was clearing. He could see their faces. The treasurer looked at his shriveled, dangling genitals. "You call yourself a man?" Ray's heart was thumping hard enough to burst, and he was filled with a deep, consuming terror unlike anything he had ever known. He had never seen any of these men up close before, not this close at least, and they were older than he'd thought, their skin wrinkled and almost translucent, like ancient parchment. There was also something else about them, something strange and undefinable that he could not quite place, but that frightened him to the bone. The president stepped forward. He was not snickering, and there was no smile on his face, only righteous anger. "Neil warned you, told you to behave." His voice was quiet but growing stronger, tone and volume steadily mounting. "I thought he and his committee made it abundantly clear that we would not put up with any more of your shit!" One knuckled fist hit the side wall, causing Liz's perfume bottles to shake on their shelf. The other men were nodding assent. Ray wanted to step calmly out of the shower stall, dry himself with a towel, and put on his bathrobe as they lectured him, but they were all pressing closer, and he knew that would not be possible. His heart rate accelerated, and though he tried to respond, tried to say something, his mouth would not cooperate, and all it did was cough. The treasurer casually picked up Liz's can of hairspray. There was nothing casual going on here, though, and Ray steeled himself to be sprayed in the face, in the eyes. Instead, the old man cocked his arm back and threw the metal can as hard as he could at Ray's midsection. The bottom rim connected solidly with Ray's stomach, drawing blood and a gasp of pain. The can clattered to the floor of the shower stall. "I thought everything was made clear," the president said. "I thought you understood." This was it, Ray knew. There was no way they could expect to get away with this sort of harassment. No way they could think that he would not turn them into the authorities. They could not expect to shut him up after invading his house like this. Not unless they planned to kill him. And that's exactly what the feeling in his gut told him was about to happen. He saw all the evidence he needed in the president's eyes. The bathroom seemed to be getting smaller as the six black-robed men pressed forward, advancing on him. Ray looked around desperately, trying to figure out some way to get by them, some means of escape. But the only window was a small opaque one above the toilet, and the board members had taken up all available space between the shower and the door. He was trapped. They weren't wearing gloves, he noticed, and a wild optimism flared within him. They'd left their fingerprints all over the doorknobs and anything else they'd touched. So maybe they weren't planning to take this all the way. At the very least, if worse came to worst, they'd be caught. Even Hitman couldn't shield them from a murder rap, not with Liz on their backs. "We heard that you were rabble-rousing, inciting rebellion, telling people to..." He inhaled deeply, grimacing, obviously having difficulty even speaking the words. "Ignore the CC&Rs." There'd been a spy at the party, a traitor, and Ray quickly ran down a list of names and faces, trying to figure out who'd betrayed them. Frank, he thought. It had to be Frank. Everyone's an informant. He should have heeded his own dictum, not been so open in his dissent, so free and easy with his opinions. He had not entirely trusted Frank since the man had tried to defend the association after Barry's cat had been killed, and Ray should have been more circumspect around him. Hell, he shouldn't have invited him to the party. But he had always been one to see the best in individuals, even those who belonged to organizations and institutions he distrusted, and he had given Frank the benefit of the doubt. Ray looked into the angry eyes of the president. The smart thing to do would be to deny everything, to explain that he was drunk at the time, to bow down to the board and kiss their asses, but he had the feeling that nothing would make any difference, so he stood up straight. "I did," he admitted. "And I told them fuck the association." "You worthless little shit!" The president came at him and pushed. Ray slipped, fell backward, hit his head. There was a flash of horrendous pain, the warm feel of blood gushing from beneath his scalp, and he closed his eyes and lay there unmoving, hoping they would think they'd killed him, hoping this would be the end of it. But people were that stupid only in movies. These six were not about to assume anything, were not about to walk away without checking whether their attempts to kill him had been effective. And as he lay there bleeding and in agony, trying to feign lifelessness, he was yanked out of the shower by his leg. His head hit the edge of the stall, and bleeding erupted from a new fissure behind his ear. He opened his eyes, but his vision was strobing, and he could not see. There was only a moving blackness against a pale, blurred background, the robed figures of the board encircling him. Other hands grabbed his arms. He was pulled into a modified standing position and dragged out of the bathroom, into the hallway, into the kitchen. On the way, he was unceremoniously slammed against door jams and table edges and countertops. The battering seemed to restore some of the clarity to his vision. He could now see where he was, and he both saw and felt the vice president grab his right wrist and use it to swat the wall phone. Pain flared up his arm, and the receiver was knocked off the hook. He was dragged out to the living room, his right knee forced into the corner of the coffee table, drawing blood, his shoulder shoved against a potted palm stand, knocking the plant over. The vice president opened the door to the deck. He realized what was happening now. He understood what they were doing. They were making it appear as though he'd slipped in the shower and hit his head. Suffering from a disorienting head wound, he'd then staggered out of the bathroom, made his way to the kitchen where he attempted to dial 911, but, baffled and confused, he wandered into the living room, then onto the deck, where he fell over the railing and died. It would look like an accident, he realized. No one would know that he'd been murdered. As much as he hated himself for it, he began to scream, and to his horror, his screams were the high-pitched yelps of a frightened woman. The board members were laughing and joking about his manhood as they pressed his right palm against the sliding glass door and rammed his genitals against the metal doorframe. He kept screaming, and there was no thought behind it. He was not trying to frighten them off or attract attention from possible passers-by. He was screaming because he had to. It was an instinctive reaction, an innate response. They pulled him onto the deck. He wanted to remain cool, disdainful toward them to the end. He wanted to make cutting remarks that would wound and hurt them, that they would think about after he was dead, but he could not do that. He simply screamed those girlish screams as the men held his body and smashed it repeatedly against the railing until a just-painted 2x4 came loose. He could feel nothing below the waist, but his arms were working and he could still see through the blood, and he attempted to break his fall as he flew through the air and landed with a bone-crushing thud on the rocky soil of the wooded sloping hillside. He was still alive. The realization filled him not only with hope and an insane glee, but with the unshakable desire for revenge. Despite their best efforts, the board had been unable to eradicate him, and their ineffectiveness would be their downfall. He did not know if he could move, if he was paralyzed or simply badly injured, but he knew enough to remain still. They were no doubt watching from above, and it would be best to play dead for a while. He could check his vital signs later. But there was no later. He must have drifted into unconsciousness, because in what seemed like seconds, he was squinting through half-closed lids and drying blood at the feet of the board members. They were implacable, and more than anything else, it was their relentlessness that finally sapped the last of his will and hope. Ray opened his eyes, not caring if they knew. He saw the president accept a large rock from one of the other board members, place it on the sloping ground inches from his face, then methodically repeat the procedure. He felt several sets of hands lift the top half of his body, and he understood what they were going to do. Please, he thought, let it be quick and painless. But no death was quick, he realized. No death was painless. And in a second that seemed to last an hour, that realization was brought home to him in a very profound and personal way. 19. The Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions, Article 4, General Provisions, Section 6, Paragraph A. Punishment for noncompliance with the terms of these covenants, conditions, and restrictions is to be determined by unanimous consent of the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Board of Directors. 20. After the funeral, they all went back to Liz's, where even with the large gathering of people, the house seemed curiously empty. Maureen, along with Audrey Hodges and Tina Stewart, had made the food and organized the informal social. The three women were gamely trying to get Liz involved, to keep her occupied with small details and thus prevent her from dwelling obsessively on her husband's death. But even amid the low buzz of multiple conversations, Ray's loss was acutely felt, and Barry could not help thinking how lonely this house would seem once all the people were gone and Liz was by herself. He stood with Frank and Mike, and the three men watched their wives shunt a zombified Liz across the living room to refill an hors d'oeuvre plate. They were talking about road construction on the highway that had narrowed the route to Interstate 15 down to two lanes. They had been talking about baseball, and the weather, gas prices, anything except Ray. They didn't know each other well enough to open up, to be emotionally truthful and share their feelings, and the three of them had been assiduously avoiding the one subject they'd each been thinking about. Ray had been the catalyst between them, the one who enabled them to speak honestly in front of one another, and with him gone, there was a stiltedness to their interaction. He felt the way he had when Todd Ingalls, his best friend from kindergarten through third grade, had moved away, and he'd been forced to play with John Wakeman, a casual friend, a backup friend, someone with whom he eventually found he had almost nothing in common. Now, Frank and Mike were his backup friends, and while they seemed like good guys, it was not the same. Not the same at all. He hadn't realized how much he had come to rely on Ray, how close the two of them had become. There was deep sorrow within him when he thought about the old man, and as he looked out the windows at the crowded deck, it hit him that they would never again sit out there barbecuing and discussing the big issues, or just shooting the breeze. It was as though a huge chunk of his life had simply been cut out and discarded, and what was left behind was a painful emptiness. Along with the sadness, however, there was anger. He had not yet figured out how, but he knew in his gut that the association had been involved in Ray's death. Not directly, that's not the way they worked, but in a circumspect roundabout way, not doing the deed themselves but bringing about the circumstances that allowed it to happen. From across the room, he caught the eye of Greg Davidson, who nodded a weary hello. Greg and Winona, he knew, were moving out this weekend, priced out of their own home by Benita Vista's gate. That's how the association operated. They were facilitators. He thought about Deke Meldrum, lying dead in the ditch as a crowd gathered in the darkness. Sometimes they were direct, though. Sometimes they did the dirty work themselves. There's no telling what they're capable of. Maureen and the other wives brought Liz by to say hello and accept condolences, and the three men reiterated what they'd said at the funeral, how sorry they were for her loss, how much they'd miss Ray. He was a great friend. Barry kept his words short and sweet. He was unnerved by the listlessness of Liz's gaze. It was like looking at a completely different woman than the one he knew, and he glanced at her for only brief seconds before turning his attention back to Maureen. It was pathetic and heartless and selfish and self-centered, but he felt extremely uncomfortable. He was not one of those people who was good with the sick or the troubled or the dying. He could write about it, but in real life he was a complete washout when it came to offering others emotional support. Thank God there were people like Maureen, who always knew the right thing to do and who had the constitution to follow through.
"Can you help us in the kitchen for a moment?" Maureen asked.
"Sure." He followed the women, leaving Frank and Mike to their own devices. Audrey and Tina busied themselves at the sink and dishwasher, while Maureen led him over to the breakfast nook, where an old leather suitcase sat atop the table. She glanced toward Liz and lowered her voice.
"Ray's books," Maureen said. "For some reason, she packed a whole bunch of them in this suitcase and then put the suitcase here on the kitchen table. I don't know how she even lifted the thing. We could barely move it."
Barry nodded. Grief did strange things to people, and somehow this irrational act, more than anything that had gone before, more than the words and the tributes and the funeral itself, brought home to him the enormity of Ray's passing. Liz had obviously loved him a lot.
"What do you want me to do with it?"
"Take it into his den," Maureen whispered. "Just get it out of the way. We'll figure things out later."
He nodded, grabbing the handle of Ray's suitcase, feeling the heaviness of the books inside. The anger rose within him.
"God damn that homeowners association," he said. "I know those bastards are behind this."
He was speaking to Maureen rather than Liz, but it was Liz who reacted, who responded to his accusation. She strode over, her gaze hardened, suddenly focused.
"I don't want to hear anything about that association stuff," she said fiercely. "That craziness was why he was out there on that deck to begin with. If he hadn't been so paranoid about those people, he'd probably be alive today."
Barry said nothing. He did not want to argue with her, did not want to cause her even more pain, and he picked up the suitcase and looked over at Maureen. His wife's expression was unreadable. Walking out of the kitchen, he saw Liz revert, her body slump, the tension that had momentarily animated her giving out and disappearing as if vacuumed away. He carried the heavy suitcase down the hall. How had she lifted it? He was struggling with it himself. He found the closed door and placed the oversized piece of luggage on the floor of the darkened den. Glancing about, he saw the hulking shadow of Ray's empty desk in the otherwise Spartan room, and he quickly hurried back out to the hallway, unaccountably feeling as though he were intruding on the couple's privacy. He closed the door behind him.
Had the association really been behind Ray's death?
He wanted to think that was the case, but he realized that he was grasping at straws, ready to believe any conclusion save the logical one. His friend's death had been an accident. Barry took a deep breath. He was turning into one of those conspiracy nuts, those loonies who saw government plots behind all ill events, who believed in Bigfoot and UFOs, who refused to believe in luck or chance or even fate, and attributed even the smallest occurrence to the complex and illogical machinations of a group of ultra-organized human beings. And he was forced to admit the possibility that Ray had been one of those people, too. Sometimes, he thought, the simplest explanation was the real one. Sometimes what was obvious was what was true, and looking for elaborate reasons was just a waste of time. Still, he was glad there was no one from the association who had come by to offer sympathy, that there'd been no official attempt at wishing Liz condolences. It would have been hypocritical at the very least, and an insult to Ray's memory. He walked back out to the living room. Frank had wandered off somewhere, but Mike was still in place, talking to a woman with a broken arm, and Barry grabbed a drink off the coffee table and joined them. "Moira? Barry," Mike said by way of introduction. Moira and her husband Dan live around the side of the hill in that stilt job. Dan used to be a contractor, and he's the one helped Ray figure out how to build that famous storage shed. "He couldn't make it today," Moira explained, "so I came alone." Barry's a writer, hooked up with Ray because of their mutual hatred of the Homeowners Association. Already, that description sounded embarrassing, childish, and he found that he was ashamed to be identified in such a way. "What happened to your arm?" Barry asked in an attempt to change the subject. He gestured toward the cast and sling. The woman reddened, became suddenly taciturn, the openness of her expression closing down. "It was an accident," she said in a voice that didn't sound at all sure that that was the case. Over her right shoulder, Mike was shaking his head, making a slashing motion across his throat that Barry interpreted to mean stay away from that subject. Spousal abuse, he thought, and was surprised at how calm he was with it, how unshocked and unfazed he was. In his dreams, in his fantasies, he was one of those people who got involved, who alerted the authorities, who stepped in and put a stop to wrongs and made them right. But here he was confronted with a situation, and he did not rise to the occasion. Like Mike, he felt more comfortable staying out of it, minding his own business and tiptoeing around that 500-pound gorilla in the middle of the room. This day was just full of surprises. The afternoon quickly wound down as people who'd put in a token appearance and performed their neighborly duty excused themselves and headed home. This wasn't a party, after all. No one was having fun at this extremely awkward gathering, and Barry could see the relief on people's faces as they expressed their condolences to Liz one last time and escaped out the door, claiming prior commitments and suddenly urgent household chores. When Mike and Frank left, leaving their wives behind, Barry decided he might as well do the same. Maureen gave him her approval and walked with him to the front door. They'd driven to the Dysons' house, to Liz's house, directly from the cemetery, but Barry felt like walking home, and he told Maureen to drive the car back when she was through. She accompanied him out to the porch, closing the door carefully behind her. "What do you think?" she asked, her eyes meeting his. "Do you think it was an accident?" He was surprised that she was even asking the question. "Probably," he admitted. She nodded, but there was not the certainty in her face he would have expected, and he wondered if she'd heard something or seen something that made her suspect this was not the case. He didn't ask her, though. Didn't want to know, not right now at least. And he said goodbye, gave her a quick peck on the lips, and headed up the gravel driveway. The air was hot and unmoving, not leavened by even the hint of a breeze, and the only sounds on this still afternoon were the scratchy scuttlings of lizards in the underbrush abutting the road, the chirrups of unseen cicadas, and the occasional far-off rumbling of truck engines as Corbin pickups headed on or off the highway. Bonita Vista seemed like a ghost town, as though all of the people had suddenly disappeared, and while in one of his stories that would have seemed creepy, Barry found the absence of audible neighbors almost welcoming. He felt better being outside, walking, even in this heat. Ray's house had been so close to the man, so filled with his memory, that it had been difficult to think, to sort things through. It was easier out here, alone under the wide blue sky, to remember the good things about his friend, to celebrate his life rather than mourn his passing. Ahead, Barry saw the entrance to his own driveway and the brown shingle roof of his house above the line of trees. As he drew closer and more of the house became visible, he saw something else, something that made his jaw muscles clench and the blood pump faster through his veins. A pink piece of paper attached to the screen door. The association had been here. He was filled with a rage entirely disproportionate to the offense, a rage he knew to be misplaced anger at his friend's death, but he felt it nonetheless, and he strode furiously up the driveway and up the porch steps. Those bastards had been here, snooping around, while he'd been at Ray's funeral, while he and his wife and their neighbors had been consoling the old man's widow. Did they have no shame? Did they have no respect? He ripped the paper from the screen and read it. The association was fining them $50 because the string Maureen had used to tie up her drooping chrysanthemums was white instead of green. All lines or cords used by a homeowner to tie plants to stakes were required to be green in order to blend in with the foliage and not distract from the lot's natural state. He felt the muscles of his face harden into a painful grimace, and he squeezed shut his eyes.
"Fuckers!" he yelled at the top of his lungs. "Fuckers!"
Taking a deep, harsh breath, tears stinging his eyes, he crumpled up the paper, balled it in his fist, and walked angrily into the house. 21. July. The monsoons came just as Ray had promised they would. With the turn of the calendar page, afternoon skies were suddenly filled with massive thunderheads, and short summer storms brought the nearly unbearable heat of midday down to a level that made for cool and unpleasant evenings. From the deck, Barry could watch the buildup of the storms, see the coalescing clouds, watch the rain as it came up from the south and moved like a light white curtain over the canyonlands and through the hilly forest toward Corbin and Bonita Vista. It was beautiful, and he wished he were writer enough to capture that ephemeral splendor. But his forte was the grotesque, not the sublime, and translating such a magnificent sight into words was beyond his abilities. He sat with Maureen, drinking iced tea, staring out at the landscape. There were scattered showers to the south, squares of gray and white that touched the earth and looked like ghostly extensions of the more solid clouds above. Occasional spikes of lightning and the rumble of accompanying thunder belied the tranquility of the scene, but were nevertheless equally majestic, and at one point Barry saw three jagged bolts of lightning hit the ground at once. From the road came the sound of a mufferless engine, and Barry peeked over to see who it was. A second later, a pickup packed with sand came speeding up the road, the vehicle's driver obviously attempting to get a running start on the steepest part of the hill. Despite the driver's intentions, the grade proved too tough, and the truck stalled out just above their house. The pickup was blocked from view by a pine tree, but Barry heard the engine attempting to turn over, and after one false start, the vehicle slid back down the hill into view, braking to a hard stop directly in front of their driveway. He looked over at Maureen. "Don't you even think about it," she said. "The guy obviously needs help, and this isn't California," he pointed out. "It's not part of some scam. He's not going to shoot us and rob us." "Never can tell." He shook his head and was about to go downstairs and ask the man if he needed any assistance, when another pickup pulled up behind the first and stopped. "Saved by the bell," Maureen said. The man who emerged from the second truck was tall and heavy, wearing two new jeans, a fancy western shirt, and the sort of shiny oversized belt buckle that had been fodder for urban comedians for decades.
A shock of white hair over a ruddy bulldog face gave the man an air of impatient arrogance, and while Barry had automatically assumed that the man had stopped to help, he knew even before the cowboy opened his mouth that that was not the case. "You got a permit?" The driver, who stuck his head out of the window to answer, was dark and spoke in a thick Mexican accent.
"Yes, sir. Of course, I have my green card."
"I don't mean a permit to work in this country. I figure you got that. I'm talking about a work permit for Bonita Vista. Does your boss have a permit to do work in our neighborhood?" Sound carried up here, but if there was an answer, Barry couldn't hear it. "You see, you gotta get the permission of the Homeowners Association before you can do any work in Bonita Vista. Any work. I don't care what the man hiring you said, that's the way it is. Comprende?" There was derision in the Spanish word. Derision and an aggressive hostility. Barry could hear it all the way up on the deck, and it was clear that the driver sensed it as well. His response was low and cowed, subservient. He immediately tried to start the truck again, and although the first two efforts were unsuccessful, on the third the engine caught and held. The white-haired man thunked his hand on the door of the pickup. "Now you turn this baby around, and you tell your boss what I told you, you hear? No permit from the association, no work in Bonita Vista. Got it?" Again, if there was an answer, Barry didn't hear it, but the pickup did not try to continue up the road, and instead backed around the other truck and headed down the hill in reverse, the loud engine fading into the distance. The white-haired man returned to his own vehicle. He looked up at Barry as he walked, scowling, as if aware that his conversation had been overheard, and Barry quickly looked away, moving out of the man's line of sight, nervous for some reason, not wanting to acknowledge that he'd been listening. The man got in his pickup and drove away.
"Did you hear that?"
Barry asked Maureen. She sipped her iced tea, nodded. "There are racist assholes everywhere." That was not what Barry had gotten from the exchange, although it was undoubtedly true. He had the distinct impression that any worker, regardless of his ethnicity, would have been questioned. It was not a race thing. It was an association thing. He looked out once again at the approaching storm, but the pettiness of the people on the ground had drained the majesty from the sky, and he was no longer able to enjoy the view the way he had before. They sat there the rest of the afternoon, as the rain approached and overtook them, whip-crack thunder that sounded simultaneously with the flash of paparazzi lightning shaking the house and rattling the windows as though they were in an earthquake. They bore the brunt of the storm for a good half hour before it finally broke, and Maureen went back inside to start dinner. Barry remained on the deck as dusk approached, ignoring the book he'd brought out to read, simply staring at the scenery. The sunset was dazzling. A section of the butte that stood like a sentinel at the far-off end of the forest where it segued into Desert Canyon was illuminated by a swath of light that lent the tan rock a brilliant fiery orange hue. The remnants of the afternoon's monsoon clouds dispersing across the western sky were transformed into what looked like puffy strings of cotton candy by the gradations of pink generated by the setting sun. It was impressive. It was awe-inspiring. But as hard as he tried to enjoy the view, he could not stop thinking about the cowboy and the Mexican worker and the homeowners association. The next day was the 4th. The 4th of July had never been one of their big holidays, and although they slept in, waking up over an hour later than usual, they made no special plans to celebrate. Maureen allowed him to barbecue fat-free hot dogs for dinner in a modified concession to tradition, but the remainder of their plans consisted of doing yard work during the day and watching TV at night. The day passed uneventfully, and they stopped working when the rains came, Maureen grabbing the rake, clippers, and broom, with Barry taking the shovel and the half-filled hefty bag, both of them running for the shelter of the lower deck. The storm quit in time for him to barbecue, and they ate in front of the television, watching the two Flint movies back-to-back on AMC. Afterward, they showered together, made love, and went to sleep early. They were startled awake by a loud boom that sounded like a bomb going off in the air above the house, but that Barry recognized instantly as the sound of fireworks. Despite the recent rains, it had been an exceptionally dry spring, and the National Forest sign at the edge of town still had Smokey the Bear pointing to a red flag, warning of high fire danger. Barry's first thought was to wonder who was stupid enough to set off fireworks under such conditions. He got out of bed, slipped on a robe, and walked over to the sliding glass door. He pulled aside the curtain and watched a fat raccoon scramble off the lower deck and down an adjacent tree. Maureen, still naked, moved up behind him and leaned on his shoulder, yawning in his ear.
Were those fireworks?
Sounded like it, but I don't see... Another one went off, the trace appearing to originate from the bottom of the hill near the tennis courts. A weak blue burst temporarily lit up a close section of sky, sparkles falling onto the pines.
Isn't that a fire hazard?
Maureen asked, suddenly more awake.
It seems like it to me.
You think someone's setting them off illegally? Maybe kids are... Barry shook his head. These are professional fireworks. Kids don't have the equipment to shoot off skyrockets like this. You need launchers. Besides, these kinds of fireworks are expensive. They waited for several moments, but nothing else went up. Maybe they were illegal, he conceded. Maybe the police or the rangers or the firemen got to them already and put a stop to it. No, Barry pointed. Another trace went up, and an anemic burst of red exploded above the trees. Maureen smiled. If this is supposed to be professional, it's pretty pathetic. We're spoiled. In Southern California, spectacular fireworks could be viewed every weekend at various tourist attractions, along with the ubiquitous nightly displays at Disneyland, consistently impressive shows that could be seen from the beach to the Fullerton Hills. They stood, waited, and a few minutes later, another skyrocket went off.
I'm going to bed, Maureen said, yawning. This isn't worth staying up for.
Barry agreed, and they both went back to bed, falling asleep to the intermittent sounds of exploding gunpowder. Barry awoke late. Maureen was already out of bed, and the smell of eggs and hash browns wafted down from upstairs. He dressed quickly, ran a hand through his hair, and headed up to the kitchen. It was a beautiful day. Maureen had opened all the drapes and windows, and morning sunlight streamed in from a cloudless blue sky. "Breakfast'll be ready in a few minutes," Maureen pointed her spatula at a folded newspaper lying atop the dining table. "Check out the paper. Top story."
"Got any coffee?"
"Check out the paper first." Barry walked over to the table, unfolded the newspaper, and stared down at the banner headline. Bonita Vista to set off fireworks despite fire danger. He started reading. The Corbin Weekly Standard came out every Tuesday, its stories written the week or weekend before, so there was no reporting on last night's display, only a pre-event article that addressed the situation from the vantage point of a few days prior. But there was no mistaking the tone of the piece or the anger that quoted Corbinites seemed to feel toward the arrogance of the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association, sponsors of the display. Apparently, Corbin was running short on water this summer due to the extended drought conditions of the previous winter, something of which Barry had not been aware. Several years before, a similar situation had arisen, and for 2 weeks in mid-July, before late monsoons once again raised the water table, tanker trucks from Salt Lake City had brought water to the town and people had been forced to line up with plastic containers in order to get drinking water. Such an extreme situation was not expected this year, but voluntary rationing was currently in place, and it was suggested that people with lawns not water them and that no one wash their cars. The article went on to say that Bonita Vista had its own wells, so it was not tied to the Corbin water supply and was not suffering the same shortage. But water district officials said that it was still callous, insensitive, and potentially devastating to the surrounding forest to put on the display. Those fireworks could cause a fire that would require digging into our reserves and could completely deplete our water resources, the superintendent said. A representative of the Forest Service concurred, adding that it would take several weeks of consistent monsoons before the trees and brush were no longer dried out and the area was no longer considered at risk.
The chief of the volunteer fire department said bluntly that his men should not have to bail out Bonita Vista because of their short-sightedness and stupidity, but that they would have to, since a blaze would endanger the town and surrounding countryside. The homeowners' association didn't care about these objections, and intended to continue with their display no matter what. The final quote in the story was from his old pal Neil Campbell. "We're not just doing this for the benefit of Bonita Vista," Campbell stated. "These fireworks will be able to be seen for miles, and everyone will be able to enjoy them. They're our present to the town of Corbin and the people living in this area. Happy 4th of July!" Barry looked up and grimaced. "I need some coffee," he said. Maureen motioned toward the coffee maker. "I figured you would." Jesus. Not only was it stupid from a PR standpoint, but it was dangerous on top of that. And the fireworks sucked besides. "According to Ray, we don't even have any fire hydrants up here. One of the few things the association's actually supposed to do, take care of public safety, they can't be bothered with. It's more important to fine us over the color of our garden ties than make sure we can fight off a forest fire." "Typical," she said. Barry poured himself a cup of coffee. "Are you still enamored with your precious homeowners association?" "I was never enamored." "But you're a little less happy with them now than you used to be, aren't you?" She scooped up a pile of hash browns, then placed a fried egg next to the potatoes on the plate. "Here," she told Barry. "Breakfast's ready. Eat." 22. The writing had stopped. Barry still went down to his office each day, still fired up the old computer, still sat in his chair in front of the screen and attempted to finish the novel that was rapidly approaching its deadline. But nothing came. This time, he conceded, it might be writer's block. His inability to progress any further with his story coincided precisely with Ray's death. He'd taken a few days off because he hadn't felt like working. Then the weekend of the 4th had arrived, and he never worked on a holiday weekend. But when he finally went down to his office the following week, he discovered that the well had run dry. He knew exactly what was going to happen next in the narrative. He'd plotted out in his mind the events that were to take place in the current chapter, and all he really had to do was fill in the blanks, but he just couldn't seem to get from A to B. He was stymied, stuck. And he'd been stuck now for almost a week. Logically, there was no reason this should have occurred. He'd been under deadline 2 years ago when his mom had died, and he'd managed to finish that book on time. Hell, he'd found the writing process therapeutic, and he'd ended up finishing the novel ahead of schedule, focusing on it to the exclusion of nearly everything else. And his mom had certainly meant more to him than Ray. But still, the writing had stopped. He'd said nothing to Maureen, had been pulling a Jack Torrance on her, but oddly enough, he'd found himself confiding in Hank and Bert and the gang at the coffee shop. They'd been cool to him after the debacle of the fireworks, unable this time to completely divorce him from the actions of Bonita Vista, but he assured them that he was just as outraged as they were, and he described the way he and Maureen had been awakened by the blasts and had had no idea where they'd been coming from. His explanation was accepted, but there was not the wholesale, wholehearted forgiveness that had accompanied his protestations of innocence after the dog death. He'd been in the wrong place at the wrong time once too often, and it was clear to him that if it happened again, suspicion would definitely be directed his way. It was not fair, but he understood it. He might not condone the actions of the association, but he lived in Bonita Vista, paid his dues, and bore some of the responsibility. And as much as he tried to disassociate himself from his neighbors and align himself with the townies, the fact was that there was no rationing in the gated community. The realities of the water shortage did not affect him, and he felt a little like a condescending nobleman assuring the poor populace that he sympathized with their plight and understood their feelings. Even now, over a week later, he still sensed some residual resentment, not on the part of Hank or Lyle or any of the core group, but from some of the casual coffee shop patrons, and while he didn't like it, he could not really blame them. Once again, he spent the morning in front of his computer. He tried to concentrate on the unfinished novel before him, but as usual, his mind wandered to other things. An old girlfriend, the movie he'd watched last night on HBO, the groceries he needed to buy on the way home today, what he'd do with the money if he sold his next novel for $10 million. He usually ate lunch around noon, but nothing was happening here, and he closed up shop shortly after 11, heading over to Burt's. It hadn't rained yesterday, the first time in over a week, and the air was hot and dry. Grasshoppers jumped up from the path before him, and several bounced off his jeans. Bert, his daughter, and a youngish, short-haired man Barry didn't recognize were the only ones in the coffee shop, but Joe arrived soon after Barry sat down and ordered his iced tea, and 15 minutes after that, the regulars were all in place. Lyle was the last to show up, and he had news. "Word is," he said, sitting in his usual seat, "that the water restrictions are going to be lifted if we have one more week of monsoons."
"Who told you that?"
"I was down at the office paying my bill, and I overheard Shelley talking to Graham in the back." Hank snorted.
"About time."
"I guess," Joe said loudly, "that Bert can start serving water again without charging, huh?" "Don't hold your breath," Bert called out from behind the counter. Ralph Griffith glanced over at Barry. "You know, I was heading down the ranch road yesterday when I saw this Lexus come out of the gate at Bonita Vista, all shiny and just washed. There was water still dripping off the hood."
"Hey," Barry said good-naturedly, "I haven't washed my Suburban in months. You can go out back and check."
They all laughed. "I wasn't saying anything against you," Ralph said. "I was just commenting that some of those rich guys in Bonita Vista are washing their cars right before a rainstorm while I can't even fill up my little boy's plastic pool with water." The laughter died down.
"Face it," Hank said. "There are selfish pricks everywhere. And if the situation was reversed and we had water and Bonita Vista didn't, you can be damn sure that there'd be people washing their cars and watering their lawns and flaunting it. It's human nature."
"But don't you think there are more of them in Bonita Vista?" Ralph pressed.